you go out with your canoe and you start with paddling, you're sitting, the sun is shining, you have the nature.
The peace and quiet and all the things you can do. Well, you get to roast marshmallows and hot dogs and swim.
Well, I'm gonna blog, baby, for he's my mind. Yeah, I'm gonna blog, baby, for he's my mind. Hanging out down here, keeps me red all the time. And I'm gonna blog, baby, for he's my mind.
The world becomes simpler out there.
So this is going to be a great story if we live through it.
And I hope I get to see you out there.
This is the Boundary Waters Podcast.
Hello, hello, everyone. I'm excited to be here. My name is Corey Maria Dack. I use she, her, or ella in Espanol pronouns. I am from Duluth, Minnesota, but I was born in Ecuador, so I'm a transracial, transnational adoptee. I was adopted from Ecuador when I was 3 months old, and I have been a canoe guide in the Boundary Waters for, this is my 17th year now, but I started working in the outdoors. This is going on 20 years.
Podcast host Lindsay Gao takes it from here.
And you and I met... I was getting my wilderness first responder training, and you were getting recertified, right?
Yeah, up at Camp Minojin, where I still work in the summers.
Tell everyone about your connection to the Boundary Waters.
Absolutely. Oh, the Boundary Waters, love of my life. I actually did not grow up outdoorsy at all. I grew up partly in Duluth, and I actually did K through 12 in Hastings because my parents divorced when I was like 4 or 5. We never really ever went camping or to national parks. I don't think I'd even heard of the Boundary Waters until high school. I'd always wanted to go to summer camps, but those things were just never financially accessible for my family. We couldn't afford to go to summer camps, and that's also why my mom and stepdad didn't really take us camping. My stepdad actually grew up going to Camp Minojin and worked there, and it was a huge part of his life. But, you know, financial barriers are a really big deal. And so even though he was a person who Minojin had influenced him greatly his whole life, we just couldn't quite get there ourselves. So growing up, I really didn't even think about being a canoe guide. I didn't know about the Boundary Waters. I was really invested in Broadway musicals and boy bands, and I was thriving and living a happy life, but I wasn't outdoorsy at all. And when I was 21 years old, my oldest friend had grown up going to Camp Vermilion, and she said, hey, I'm going to work at Camp Vermilion this summer. You should work with me. You love working with kids, and you always wished you had gotten to go to summer camp. And so I said, heck yeah, like, let's give this a try. It was like being on another planet with a totally different culture. I showed up wearing platform flip-flops, and I saw someone wearing a sweatshirt that said the North Face on it, and I thought that was a band. So I was just from another planet, but I loved working with the kids. And within Camp Vermilion was a small section known as Canoe Country that did what Camp Minojin does. It was a tripping portion, and they had, instead of camp counselors, they had canoe guides. The guides would take people out for week-long Boundary Waters canoe trips. And I remember meeting the guides and thinking that to be a canoe guide sounded like the most terrifying, reckless, dangerous thing I had ever heard of. I was like, you guys sleep on the ground. You have to build a fire to cook. You have to read a map and use a compass to get around. There are bears. There are wolves. I don't know how to tie any knots other than my shoelaces. And I remember thinking, this sounds like a terrible job. Why would anyone do it? I could and would never do anything like that. And here we are, 17 years later, still doing it. What was really impactful, as I became friends with the guides, they started showing me that I did have the right heart to be a guide and to take people out on these Boundary Waters adventures. And we used to call them hard skills and soft skills, and I'm glad we don't use that terminology anymore. The technical skills, like tying knots and reading a map and compass, building a fire, sterning a canoe, portaging, And then we used to call the human skills soft skills, which is really silly because there's nothing soft about having good judgment, making good decisions. There's nothing soft about empowering youth or comforting a crying child. Those things are actually like pretty difficult. And the community at Camp Vermilion, they always said, Corey, you already have the human skills. Those are the ones that are much harder to teach. You love working with kids, you make good decisions, you build community. We can teach you the technical skills. And so because I had this really empowering community at Camp Vermilion, I decided to give it a try. So my first time ever in the Boundary Waters, I was 24 years old, and it was staff training to be a guide. It was my first ever canoe trip, and I cried every single day on trail. I cried every single day, sometimes because it was so beautiful, sometimes because I was laughing so hard and having fun, but mostly I cried because I was like, this is a mistake. I'm not cut out for this. I don't really belong here. But the Boundary Waters were so both thrilling and peaceful and healing all at once that I just really felt that I deserved to have that experience. And even though my family hadn't had the money to give me those experiences as a child, and even though there were no other brown people in my community, I was literally the only one. And you know, it can be hard to not see people who look like you in a new experience. There's a collective sense of safety when you see another person with your identity represented, whatever that identity might be. So I felt really out of place, but something inside me just kept saying, you are worthy of this. Just keep trying your best. And, you know, you can do anything for one summer if it doesn't fit. But I kept coming back, and it's been almost 20 years.
I really appreciate your thoughts on like the skill, like, you know, the heart skills versus the technical skills. And, you know, those heart human skills are not valued as much in our society, but you're right. Those skills are difficult skills to sometimes learn and to live your life, like leading with those skills like that. That can be really difficult. Our society should be placing more values on those things, right? Like,
for sure. Yeah, that's why I'm like, why would we call those soft skills? What? And sure, tying a knot is hard, but it, compared to helping a homesick child, it's not that hard.
Yes, making people feel safe, helping kiddos emotionally regulate. And
yes,
I also really appreciated you saying kind of expressing how you didn't see yourself represented in the community that you were in at first, and how you really told yourself that I belong here and everyone belongs here in spaces like this.
Yeah. Of course, I had a lot of great people that I met in these spaces, but I also experienced a ton of microaggressions and very covert racism versus overt racism. And this was 20 years ago, so I didn't have the language or the paradigm, you know, the vocabulary. We didn't talk about microaggressions 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I was experiencing them all the time, and it made me feel like I wasn't good enough, like I really didn't belong. And now as an adult and looking back on that and having this, you know, at bare minimum, having this vocabulary set, I'm like, oh, I wasn't unworthy. I just hadn't been societally conditioned the way a lot of outdoorsy white people were brought up. Mm-hmm. And I was a big, different type of energy. And there was nothing wrong with that. I definitely had some people who did not make me feel welcome. And I think nowadays, people could easily identify that as an equity barrier rooted in white supremacy and colonization. But back then, I was just like, why are you so mean to me? I've never been mean to you.
Do you remember some of those kind of microaggressions? And
for sure. What do people of color get accused of being all the time? too loud. Also, it's like a summer camp where you're supposed to hype up the kids and play games and run around. And it was a lot of disparaging remarks about like being too loud, being too much in a way that is absolutely tied to microaggressions and colonizing attitudes. I went on to get my master's in outdoor rec, outdoor education. And I had a professor who actually said in class, you know, in the national park system, for example, there's more Black families and Mexican families showing up, and they're always really loud. You know, how do we navigate that? Like, what? Like, that was something he presented as just a really thought-provoking question that we were supposed to talk about as a class, like how to deal with Blacks and Mexicans. And he thought he was coming from the perspective of, well, shouldn't Blacks and Mexicans be allowed at national parks too? But his delivery was still very othering, very much normalizing that Blacks and Mexicans aren't usually here, and here's how they're different, and here's how it bothers us normal people, aka us white people. And that was about 2010. And again, as one of the only brown people in that class, I still didn't quite have the language, but I remember sitting there and thinking, that sounds kind of racist. And I remember I did try to say something like, are they really that loud, or do different cultures just express joy differently and that's okay?
Thank you for sharing. I think those are really, really good examples of kind of the white centering language and then the othering language that really don't create a culture of safety in kind of white dominated spaces like the outdoors.
Right. I think about even leave no trace, right? What is the last principle? It's always be considerate of others, which is a fine principle at face value. But how was that always presented to me? Be quiet. If you want to be a good outdoors person, you can't be too loud. It's how it was presented, not just to me specifically, but in general and to everyone. And one, remember when you were growing up and your mom was like, use your indoor voice or go outside? Okay, now we're outside. Can't we express our joy? Like, can't we be loud? We are outside now. And Pachamama, you know, Mother Nature, it doesn't matter how much volume you have. There will be times when Mother Nature invites quiet reflection and silence. Even the most high energy people of any decibel will find themselves gazing silently at a beautiful sunset. We don't have to micromanage those moments, and we don't have to be quiet all the time. I talk about this with especially my youth and kids I take out on trail. A lot of these beautiful sacred places used to be full of people. People who made noise, people who laughed and cried and yelled and were happy and angry and sad. And the reason places like the Boundary Waters don't have people in all the time is because of settler colonialism and people getting displaced and people, you know, think of our national parks, people getting genocided out of their most sacred homelands. And when I see people in the Boundary Waters, I try to teach my kids to celebrate that moment. Like, hey, isn't it cool that we just said hi to someone on a portage or we waved to a different canoe? Because that's what it used to be like. People used to live out here. It used to be thriving with the original caretakers of this water and land. So you can celebrate those moments of calm that nature will naturally invite without tone policing, because that also makes you forget what did these lakes and rivers sound like 1,000 years ago?
Oh, I appreciate you so much, Corey. I feel like you're even challenging me right now in like kind of my colonial mindset, which I know I have, right? I inherently have by growing up in the society. When I'm thinking those thoughts or things like that, and then challenging myself to really unlearn those things. It's like all of these unwritten rules that white people have created. Now I'm constantly, for myself, like challenging myself how to unlearn those rules. And by having these conversations and listening to these stories, I mean, it's very powerful. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I was raised in that same society and have been like decolonizing my own mind. And it's also interesting being a transracial adoptee. I am a brown person who was raised white in a white society in an all-white family. So all of these things I've also had to unpack, especially learning how to be a guide and starting to play outside for the first time in my life ever in my mid-20s is later than most people who end up guiding as a career. Again, yes. I was doing this. And I used to do stuff that I look back at now and I'm like, what kind of colonizer BS was I on? Like, we used to really believe that, you know, you gotta get all your stuff across the portage in one time. It was like this big, like, macho energy. And I mean, honestly, if you can, that's great. It's faster. But people would be like front pack, backpack, and canoe and literally physically hurting themselves because they had to show off how strong and macho. People of all genders adopting this energy. Obviously, there's a lot of white male energy in there too, but I didn't, and I'm not white and I'm not male. Like, a lot of us were like this back then. And now when I'm helping train new canoe guides, I'm like, especially if you're solo guiding, you have a bunch of 11-year-olds, take as many trips as you need to, because if we're trying to empower these children, turning this trip into a suffer fest just for the machismo of it all is not empowering to them. And you can't possibly be having a good time either. So what if we just listen to our bodies, and you can still be efficient while being slow and steady and taking care of yourself? I've had so many friends who've gotten hernias because they just really felt they had to one-up the canoe the whole time. And not just Kevlars, but like plastics, aluminums, wood canvas canoes. Like, you gotta one-up these canoes. Why? Why? Especially when we're working with youth, the teamwork of having two or three people put a canoe on your shoulder, that teamwork is the better and deeper and more beautiful lesson. And it also allows people to be less afraid to try portaging for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Yes. You describe yourself as an inclusivity advocate. Can you tell us a little bit more about what is an inclusivity advocate?
I feel like that merges and changes all the time, but definitely a thing that I feel just down to my bones is that everyone deserves to experience, for example, a place like the Boundary Waters. There's so much deep generational healing, you know, trauma we have learned through science, what a lot of cultures already knew for many years, that, you know, trauma gets passed on generationally, but so does healing. It's not just the trauma that gets passed on. And nature is one of the greatest healers. We all know it. That's why we go out and we play. But it's not easy for everyone to get there. So one, trying to bridge what we call like equity gaps to make it more accessible for people of all walks of life, all colors, all identities, all financial backgrounds. Finances are a really big one as well. To bridge those equity gaps so that other people can experience that joy, that adventure, that healing, that peace. And then also just the power of representation. You know, if you can see it, you can be it. And when I was little, I did not know any fat-bodied, brown, indigenous Latina women doing this. And when I started guiding, I didn't know any fat-bodied, brown, indigenous Latina women doing this. And now I, as a fat-bodied, brown, indigenous Latina woman, I hope that I can help inspire other little brown kids and other fat-bodied people and other immigrants to think, hey, Corey's out there doing this. Maybe I can too. Because I think if I had received that message, it would have been great to have a role model like that when I was younger. So part of me doing this is also for like my inner child, for like my little Corey from back in the day, and hoping that other people have that kind of role model for them.
Yes. Yes. I love that.
I work also for Wilderness Inquiry, and they have this wonderful program I love called Canoemobile, where the whole existence of it is to bridge those equity gaps. And so I've led 10 national tours, and there are 7 of us that live out of a van. I tell people it's like being in a rock band, and you go city to city all over the United States. But instead of playing a rock concert every night in a new city, we take kids canoeing in a new city every week. And we'll take about 1,000 kids canoeing a week, because we have 6 giant North canoes. They're 24 feet long, you know, like 300-400 pounds a piece. And you can fit 10 kids in there at once. And so for a lot of kids, they show up on a field trip with their teacher and their classmates, and maybe they'll get an hour-long canoe ride. Maybe they'll only get 15 minutes. When we program in New York City, we see so many kids in New York that maybe they only have a 15-20 minute canoe ride. But for those kids, it's the greatest adventure. And that's why I never want to like put a number on an outdoor experience. It's great if you can do a 40-day trip across the Arctic, but it's also great if you do a 15-minute canoe ride in Van Cortlandt Park in the Bronx. They are both so special, and they are both so important. And I'm not saying the Arctic's not important. I'm saying we need to make room at the table for the sacredness of that first ever 15-minute canoe ride. Make room at the table to celebrate that, because in Minnesota, we're so spoiled by all the water we have access to, and even people in rural areas that don't have a lot of money can usually get somewhere to go swimming. And that's just not the case in New York and Boston and Philly and Atlanta and San Francisco and Chicago and Salt Lake City and all the other places that Canoemobile goes. And to be with kids who have been taught you don't go near the river, it's bad, it's dirty, it's polluted, it's dangerous. I had a little girl in Philly. You know, we never make a kid get into a canoe on Canoemobile. It's always their choice. We really emphasize bodily autonomy, your body, your choice. You are welcome to get in this canoe with us if you want. And one little girl in Philadelphia, she looked at me and she said, we can't canoe on this river. We were on the Schuylkill. And I said, why not? And she said, because this is where we put our dead bodies.
Oh.
And so that was her complete association with water. And I remember just kind of not knowing what to say, but I looked at her, and the only thing I could think of to say is, well, it's your choice. If you want to, you can sit right in front of me, because you know, I had the boat captain in the back. It's like, I mean, I'm not going to refute. I mean, she's not making up a story. I'm not going to do that dismissive thing where I'm like, that's not true, or it's not scary. I never tell kids it's not scary. I always say, it's okay to be scared. I was like, yeah, it can be scary the first time. It's okay to be scared. You can be scared right in front of me. I'm the boat captain. And she got in the canoe and she sat in front of me. This was in 2015. It was my first ever Canoemobile, and clearly I've never forgotten about it. What I'm saying is that to have a child with that association of nature choose to get in a canoe with her teacher and her friends for the first time, that is as sacred and holy as any great long-term high day expedition.
That is the example of the trauma and the healing, right?
Yeah.
Right there. That story, the trauma she's holding of that's where we put our dead bodies. This body of water is scary and dangerous. To I can experience it differently and maybe heal some of that fear from that trauma of having like carrying that narrative around with her.
Right.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So bridging equity gaps, you did a trip on the Mississippi, which it was so fun to follow you on that. what seemed like a very long adventure.
It really was.
Could you start off just painting a picture of like the logistics of the trip, I guess kind of the technical parts of the trip?
Well, I, a year ago, accidentally became an expert on winter canoeing because I did a full source to sea paddle of the entire Mississippi River from Lake Itasca all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. And it was not supposed to be a winter trip, but because of a lot of unplanned things that went down, it became a mostly winter trip. I left on Sunday, August 21st, 2022, and my friends and I got to the ocean on Sunday, March 5th, 2023. I think the baby steps of my career helped prepare me for it. You know, at Camp Vermilion, we started out with 5-day trips. And again, you know, not putting any emphasis just on like numbers, those 5-day trips I first went on at Camp Vermilion are what paved the way for me to do a 7-month trip. So we really love and always cherish those trips that, even if they're not super long, are so important and formative. I don't know. I never set out to make this my career. I just feel like my life has always kind of flowed like a river. Let's keep with the metaphor. And I would work somewhere for a season and an opportunity would pop up and I would think, I think I want to do this opportunity. This feels really good. And I would do that opportunity and just kind of flow to the next one. And eventually the course of my life flowed into a program called the River Semester. Really cool program out of Augsburg University in Minneapolis. And for a number of years, they partnered with Wilderness Inquiry, who also does Canoe Mobile. And it is a 100-day trip. It's like a study abroad, but instead of going to Ecuador or China, the college students are on the Mississippi River for the whole semester. And we're teaching classes full-time as well. So my co-guide and I, we were the leaders of this semester. We were the guides. We were also instructors. We also taught classes. And then there were 2 full-time professors and 15 college students. So there are 19 of us together for 100 days. And we paddled from Minneapolis all the way to the Great Confluence, which is where the Mississippi River confluences or joins with the Ohio River in Cairo, Illinois. So right on the Illinois-Missouri-Kentucky border. If you spend 100 days paddling down the Mississippi, you can't help but wonder, what does it look like above Minneapolis and below Cairo? What's it look like the rest of the way to the ocean? And a little seed started to germinate in my brain about doing a full source to sea. And that's kind of how the idea first started.
So how many miles?
Yes, there depends on who you ask. Like the Army Corps of Engineers has one statistic and other people have different, but the sign at Lake Itasca says 2,552 miles.
Wow. What was the purpose of this trip for you?
I felt if I had the privilege and the opportunity to go on a great adventure like this, that's not accessible for everyone to do. To spend several months living and paddling. And because I'm a guide, I was able to kind of work it so I wasn't doing my through paddle during my high season. You know, I guided all summer, which is why we had to start at the end of August. You know, I guided all summer so I could save up for this trip. And then I paddled in sort of my work off season. But it's still not a thing everybody can go off and do. I felt that I definitely also had a moral responsibility to do something good with this adventure. I didn't want to just be a cool person doing a cool thing for the sake of me looking cooler. And I mean, like, I did want to be cool and look cool, but I didn't want that to be like the heart of the adventure. And so I thought a lot about decolonization, which can mean many things. And the way I use it, especially on this trip, I called it decolonizing through paddling, which is a play on words, kind of like to decolonize a through paddle, a source to sea of a whole river is called a through paddle, but also to decolonize through paddling, like the verb decolonizing through the action of paddling. And so to decolonize, One way you can look at that word is to think about all the things we do and the things we say and the things we think, and think about why we say and do and think those things and how that's informed by systems of oppression. Racism, fatphobia, transphobia, misogyny, homophobia, xenophobia, capitalism, ableism, all these different things that hurt, honestly, everyone. They hurt all of us. How do those systems of oppression in oppression inform what we do? For example, how do those systems of oppression inform why someone wants to do a full through paddle of the Mississippi River? And there's a lot of reasons why people do a through paddle. And I'm not here to judge those other reasons. Again, I'm more like making room at the table for a different narrative. There are some people about a year ago who broke the Guinness Book of World Records for through paddling. They did it in 18 days. It took me like 7 months. They did it in 18 days. So obviously we had very different, you know, hearts behind why we were through paddling. But I cheered for them and I celebrated when they did it. You know, like obviously that's not how I wanted to do it, but I'm not trying to police other people's reasons. You know, like I'm anti-police anyways. I'm not trying to police you. But what I'm saying is I wanted to do it in a way that was really centering, bridging equity gaps and being in deep relationship with the land and water, prioritizing making connections with community all the way up and down the river. Like we wanted to go slow on purpose and we wanted to meet people and build relationships with people who live on the river. And we wanted to uplift the native peoples, the original caretakers of the different sections of the Mississippi River and work with other water protectors. And also I just know how identities and identity politics work. I know that the fact that I am a brown skin, fat bodied woman of color, indigenous Latina, adopted immigrant, I knew that I could also be a role model for others. At first, we wanted to hang out with people, meet people up and down the river for the heart and the spirit of the through paddle. But as winter came, meeting people also was part of surviving. I mean, we were paddling. Sometimes it was 17 degrees out, and canoeing in 17 degrees is so miserable. I cried a bunch while I paddled. I call it craddling, cry paddling. And in that time period, we would stay with people called river angels. Maybe you've heard of trail angels on like the AT or the PCT. River angels, people that live on the Mississippi or near it, and they just open their hearts to help paddlers all the way from Lake Itasca to the Gulf. There are these Facebook groups, and I would get on them and say, "Hi, my name's Corey, and my partner Sarah and I, she and I are like a couple hundred miles north of Hannibal, Missouri," and people would come out of the woodwork and say, "Oh, I live at River Mile 724, and stay with us if you would like a hot meal and a warm bed and to do your laundry, and we'll take you grocery shopping and you can refill your drinkable water here." And not only is that so amazing in general and was the number one way that we met people who lived on the river, but when it was brutally cold, we would stay with river angels whenever we could just so we didn't have to sleep outside, because until my friend Emily Ford joined me, I didn't have any winter gear. Because we were supposed to be done by Christmas originally. We were supposed to be done by Christmas, which would get us far enough south that I didn't need winter gear. And then I needed it for a long time. But Em stepped in and she helped me. I had to switch out paddle partners at one point. And when my first paddle partner went home in the Quad Cities, we weren't even halfway done. And it was almost Thanksgiving and winter was already brutal. And then my friend Sarah, who is a stranger I met on the internet, she joined me in Hannibal, Missouri, and went all the way to the ocean with me and is still one of my best friends. And Emily came in and bridged the gap between my first paddle partner and my second paddle partner. And she also, if you've heard of Emily, she is an expert winter camper and I'm an expert canoer. And so her coming onto my trip in that moment of, it was just like a crucial point in that trip. And it was perfect because I got to teach her all about life on the Mississippi River, like a long form canoeing adventure on the Miss. And she got to teach me how to winter camp because I'm Ecuadorian and I usually guide in the summers. And so we got to teach each other about our greatest joys. And it was the most healing thing that could have happened. And she got me through the locks and dams before they shut for the winter. And that was another thing. I'm another kind of panic point. Like, if I don't find another paddle partner, I'm gonna have to either quit completely or at least like miss a couple hundred miles because the locks and dams were shutting for the winter. And she got me to Hannibal, Missouri. Sarah got in my canoe and we made it all the way to the ocean together with a couple other friends who joined us further downriver.
Well, and just for the listeners, Emily Ford's been on the podcast before. Was there any like one person along that way that really stuck out to you a lot or that it is really memorable or you're holding on to?
I'm just so glad that our values were grounded in meeting people because people met us there and reciprocated times a million. I remember our first River Angels were Ron and Judy Vroom on Lake Bemidji, or on the Mississippi, just a little south of Lake Bemidji. And we called Ron River Dad. He would text us every day and be like, "Where are you girls at?" Because for a long time, it was just me and my first paddle partner, no one else. I mean, there's a million people. I would be so remiss to, like, oh my gosh, go through and name all of them. My dear friend Elaine, she is 70, 70, no, she just turned 70, and she lives on this beautiful farm in southern Illinois. And when Sarah and I got to the Great Confluence, she drove an hour to pick us up and take her to her farm. And then, if people remember Christmas season of 2022, this huge deep freeze hit the country, very different from this past Christmas. And in southern Illinois and Kentucky, it was 25 below 0 Fahrenheit. And we didn't have wetsuits, let alone dry suits. And we said, "No, we choose life. You know, I'm not trying to die on this mission, on this journey. That's really not the point of decolonizing, is killing yourself." And so we ended up staying on that farm with her in southern Illinois for 10 days over Christmas. And she's part of a really beautiful Sufi Muslim community. And the whole community took us in and took care of us and fed us. And we went to their Christmas feast and we were just so held by community. As you get lower and lower on the river, you can no longer paddle up because the river is so huge. There's giant levees everywhere, and the floodplain is so large that there's a sweet man named Mike that drove a full hour just to drop off drinkable water and a couple of bags of Fritos. And he just like met us under a bridge and passed us snacks and drinkable water. You know, just like, ah, I cried in front of so many strangers. I'm a very healthy crier. The number of people that welcomed us into their homes and into their families and into their cities, towns, and communities. And I set out to focus on community on this great through paddle. But even I could have never dreamed how much I would need them to keep going on what had turned into a suffer fest. Like, I feel proud because I always felt like if I really needed to call it, I would walk away and feel proud of myself because decolonizing a through paddle also means not killing yourself just to finish. And so I always felt grounded about continuing. But I tell people it was brutal. It was brutal and beautiful. And it was the people that helped me really feel the beauty, even when it was brutal.
When I think about colonization, it's the idea of like conquering something, like power over and then an abuse of that power. And what you're describing on this paddle is really working with something. It's like prioritizing community and support and like this welcoming, you know, safe environment, like in integrating all of these different experiences. It's like about flexibility. I mean,
Yes.
what an amazing trip. I'm so proud of you, Corey.
Thank you. It was the joy of my life, and it was also really hard. I cried a lot.
Gosh. Earlier you mentioned water protectors. I know you're a water protector. I know that you were a medic in the uprising in Minneapolis when George Floyd was murdered. I also know you did some work as a water protector with Line 3 as well. And just how does that kind of integrate into all of this?
Yes, thank you for asking. I see such a strong relationship to what they call wilderness medicine and what we call street medicine. So, you know, as we said, Lindsay and I met because we were getting our woofers together, our wilderness first responder certification up at Camp Minogen in 2017. And when George Floyd was murdered in 2020, at the time, pretty much all my guiding work contracts had dried up. You know, I was supposed to be leading a trip from Minogen, but Minogen, you know, obviously closed for the summer in 2020. And I was down in Minneapolis, and there was just so much trauma and communities were hurting, and I wanted to be helpful. And there were all these marches going on, and, you know, celebrations of joy and pourings of trauma, outpourings of trauma and despair and rage, and all the emotions were present and all were really important to be felt. And I thought, how can I be helpful? And I've always loved wilderness medicine, as it's called. And at the time, not long after Floyd had been murdered, the mayor of Minneapolis called a curfew, and a citywide curfew. And I heard a lie that I'm really grateful I heard. Someone said that medics had curfew immunity. Let the record show this is not true. Street medics do not have curfew immunity in situations. But I heard that and I was like, oh, I was already showing up to these marches with just a little homemade med kit that a friend had made for me and that I put in my little backpack with my Camelback. And I used to write medic on my arm so that people could see. And I wore like a bright yellow visor that I bought and I wrote medic on it. And I was just like, I can be helpful. I can hand out bandages and water and whatever needs to happen. But from the jump, you know, tear gas was flowing that summer. It was really terrible. And I found myself eye flushing people who had been gassed by the police. So when I heard that, I guess, quote unquote, official street medics, which is not really, it's kind of a paradox, you know, street medics are volunteer. We are not paid. We often come in collectives or organizations. I ended up getting connected to this great, great group of people called North Star Health Collective. And they are the street medics that have been serving the wonderful people of the Twin Cities area for, I feel like, 20 years now. And although street medics did not have curfew immunity, it really changed my life. Because I was unemployed, there was no Camp Minogen that summer. I just ran as a street medic full-time, like every march. Anytime something popped up unplanned, I was there with my med bag and you always run in buddies when you're a street medic with like my buddies. And I made all these new friends and became very invested in my communities down there. And the reason I got into street medicine was because when I went out to Standing Rock in 2016, there had been a call for people to show up and protect Native elders. They always had peaceful, direct actions. They were always very peaceful. Water protectors are so peaceful. At the time, people who were getting arrested during these peaceful direct actions, white people were going to local county jails and getting out for like $20. And the Native American leaders were going to federal prison. And I'm Native South American, but to a racist white person, they're not like checking my passport. And I showed up ready to like do what I needed to. And leadership there was like, oh no, sis, you are not going to the front lines. They're going to get you and you're going to go to federal prison. And I was like, yeah, I don't want to do that. What else can I do? And I saw a flyer that said, you know, street medic information, street medic training. And I thought about my woofer, this thing I've needed for my career for since 2008. And all the ways that I've practiced wilderness first responder medicine, you could say, out in the backcountry, out in nature. And I was like, that is a skill that I have. When I got vetted by North Star after Floyd was murdered, I had a little imposter syndrome. I was like, well, you know, I've been a woofer for, at that point, almost a decade, but I'm not like a nurse or a paramedic. And they said, no, actually, woofers make the best street medics. Because as a woofer, you're taught how to stabilize someone and give them care when you are cut off of all resources. And that's what a street medic does. You know, I'm not performing surgery in the streets. That's immoral. That is not part of our code of ethics. I am helping stabilize someone and give them care until we can get them to higher care. And the only difference is maybe in the Boundary Waters, I can't get to higher care because I'm a 5-day canoe paddle away from an exit point. In the heart of Minneapolis or New York City or wherever, maybe care has simply just been cut off from us because of where the police barricades are. Often ambulances will show up to an event, but the police control where the ambulances are allowed to go. So street medics, we're the boots on the ground people with our med packs, and we're with the people in the crowd providing care as needed. Man, the people at North Star, again, people entered my life that were powerful mentors. That was so empowering to me. It really helped crush that imposter syndrome voice that we all have, that we've all really been conditioned to have. And I just went out there every day and I did my best. And I took my wilderness medicine training with me to the front lines of the cities. And after that season of my life passed and I came back to guiding full time, I took all of the things I'd learned about community building and racial justice and environmental justice and how the two are actually one and the same. I'd always had that, but I had it even stronger and had some better, you know, paradigm shifts and vocabulary sets. And I've taken that with me. And that's been a heart of how I've guided ever since.
Corey, what I'm noticing about you is you just take all of your skills and all of your experiences and you just move about throughout the world trying to do good with them. That's just like just a baseline, it seems like, of who you are.
Thank you. And thank you. That really honors me. Thank you.
I hear that in all of your stories. Anything mm-hmm. else you want the listeners to take away?
I think two major things. Really recognizing how environmental justice and social justice in general, they're one and the same. Racial justice, bridging equity gaps, making people feel safe playing and living outdoors, even if they're fat or trans or don't come from money or they're not white, all of that is really connected to the same values that make us want to protect the Boundary Waters from mining. They're not different things. They're not separate votes on the ballot. They're all connected. So I encourage people to always see that intersectionality, to see those interconnected ways. Because when people are able to get to places like the Boundary Waters, the healing that occurs, Paul Wellstone is the one that said, we all do better when we all do better. Our liberation is all bound. And when we all experience that generational healing, not only do we just rise up collectively as a society, but even on a smaller level, the more people that get to play in the Boundary Waters, the more people that are going to vote to protect it. So all of this is really connected. The biggest takeaway I hope people can get from this or any interaction really with folks who are advocates in the outdoors like me is, no matter who you are, you belong. You get to go outside. You get to play outside. You get to experience the healing and the peace of a place like the Boundary Waters. You are worthy of that. It doesn't matter if you've never done anything like that. It doesn't matter if you're scared or if you haven't had experiences to quote unquote prepare you for it, you are worthy of getting the chance. Pachamama, Mother Nature, she loves all of us and every human from any part of the world. The most natural thing is for us to be in relationship with the land and the water, and that includes you.
Big thanks to Corey Dack for sharing your experiences and wisdom with the Boundary Waters podcast. Thanks too to Lindsay for making that connection. Here's the next segment of Keep It Wild on the WTIP Boundary Waters podcast.
Sharon Furland. I am the forest wildlife biologist for the Superior National Forest.
The start of the spring-summer season is fast approaching. It's also an active time for wild animals, including bears.
This time of year, bears are definitely emerging from hibernation. I've also seen some reports of mama bears with three or four cubs. So I think that the bumper crop of berries and acorns that we had last year are really going to give a little bit of a boost to our bear population. We try to track trends and reports of bears and specifically not just sightings of bears going about their business, but bears where there might be bear-human interaction.
It seems like everyone has heard a crazy story or two about bears on portages stealing packs or tearing through food packs on campsites. From your perspective and tracking these human bear encounters, is that common?
What we find is that 95% of these bear human conflicts involve food or garbage or smellables, really, what we call smellables. Bears can detect a scent like more than a mile away, and they'll be attracted to even something like sunscreen or toothpaste. I have heard of these situations at portages. It seems like we get an average of 50 reports a year over the last several years, and that's not 50 bears. That's usually multiple reports for the same bear, because once a bear has gotten a food reward, they become habituated. There's a saying that a fed bear is a dead bear. We actually suspect that some of the bears that we have reports on, they'll also teach their cubs. So in some cases, we're pretty certain that some of the more problematic bears are multi-generational kind of situations where, you know, the adult bears, they successfully got food, and then they teach their cubs, and then so that the tradition carries on. And if we are very concerned about a situation where there could potentially be a safety concern, which is pretty rare, but occasionally it does happen, then we would have to actually kill that bear. That's an action of last resort, and we really hope that we don't get to that point. You know, one of the most important things to try to prevent those situations from happening is proper food storage. And so there are some techniques that we recommend that will hopefully help avoid those bear-human conflicts from occurring in the first place.
Take us through what those best practices are so that people new to the forest and camping in the Boundary Waters will have a good idea of what to expect and what to plan for.
Yeah, absolutely. The recommendations for best practices, if you're in the front country, is actually securing it in a vehicle. So, of course, you can't do that in the Boundary Waters, but in the front country, if you're camping at one of our either dispersed campsites or a developed campsite, you can secure food in your vehicle. If you're in the Boundary Waters or, you know, more remote areas, we recommend that you use what are considered bear-resistant food storage containers. There is a group called the Interagency Grizzly Bear Committee that actually tests products with bears. They have a captive bear program, and they actually, you know, it's like the Samsonite commercial. They actually take these products and pack them with food and put them out there for the bears to access and see, you know, if the bears are successful at opening the containers or tearing into the containers. And so they actually have a list of over 500 products that have been bear tested and are bear resistant. It's hard to say anything is bear proof. So we recommend products from that list. And those products, you know, for example, they range from things like bear vault canisters to some ersacs are on that list. You can even retrofit coolers. So they have certain hinges and latches that can be bear resistant. What we found is that the generic, I'll call them blue barrels, because that's what I've heard them described as. So those generic blue barrels, which seem ubiquitous in the boundary waters, are actually not bear resistant. And so a lot of our reports, bears have gained a food reward because they'll just chew right into those blue barrels. And they've demonstrated that over and over. We'll find holes right through the outer container. When bears get a food reward, they just don't forget. I am pretty sure that some bears in the boundary waters probably target those blue barrels because they are so common. And then the third method that we recommend for proper food storage would be hanging your food or your garbage, your smellables. That can be tricky, though. Not everybody knows how to properly hang food, or there might not be a tree that's a good support system for hanging food. So that can also be a tricky method. Sometimes bears will actually figure out the hanging method, too. So one of the most successful ways is using the certified bear-resistant containers.
If someone's out and they encounter a bear that's hungry or it seems to be habituated, what do you recommend people do?
I think there's a common misconception with bears in Minnesota, which are black bears. You know, there's also grizzly bears in other parts of the country, but here in Minnesota, we only have black bears. I think a lot of folks probably assume that they are aggressive, but generally they actually are not. They can be quite gentle and smart. So, you know, the first tactic would be to give bears their space. Usually if you do that, they're going to keep their distance, mind their own business. However, as you know, you said the habituation, it does get more complicated when there's food involved and the bear has, you know, been attracted to that. So if you encounter a bear that doesn't seem to be leaving or is really persistent, you know, at a campsite or a portage, then it likely is a habituated bear. And so we recommend that, you know, you can yell at it. People bang pots. You can throw a rock at it. If it's very persistent, use bear spray. And those methods will usually result in no more conflict, hopefully.
Does that work long term if you spray a bear?
That's a good question. I mean, it is a recommended technique, but I guess there could be situations where there are some bears that have become non-responsive to bear spray. But another actually tactic that I've heard that sometimes is successful, but would not be appropriate for the boundary waters, but you could use in front country, would also be air horns.
Okay, and they're not recommended for the boundary waters. Why? Just a quick explanation.
Well, I mean, I guess technically they're not restricted from the boundary waters, but it seems like it would be a potentially a very invasive kind of experience for other users to have that's, you know, not necessarily a wilderness character kind of experience.
How do people report a bear encounter to the Forest Service?
We would love to hear about these, any of these bear-human conflicts. Again, just general bears going about their own business. That doesn't need to be reported to us, but any type of conflict that we can maybe follow up on or alert the public to if necessary, we would greatly appreciate that. And so the best way to do that is to actually call one of our district offices, one of our ranger districts. We're really grateful that you have given us some airtime actually to talk about this topic, because we really want to keep our Minnesota wild bears wild.
For links and photos, go to the Keep It Wild feature page at WTIP.org.
The Boundary Waters podcast is supported by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and WTIP, North Shore Community Radio. Our theme song is by The Bitter Spills.